Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today we have our Corey Knockreiner that we're all well familiar with, but also a special guest. We're going to sit down with an interview with Roger Grimes. Roger is a 30-year computer security veteran and the author of 10 books and over 1,000 magazine articles. He's been with InfoWorld and CSO Weekly Computer Security Columnist since 2005, and he currently works as a data-driven defense evangelist for KnowBe4. His last book, A Defense-Driven Computer Security Defense, has sold over 30,000 copies and was selected by RSA as their June 2018 Book of the Month. You can find him on Twitter at Roger A. Grimes. You can find his books on Amazon.com, and of course, check out his weekly writings on CSO Online. And with that, let's jump into the interview. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Always am.
Awesome. Let's just go ahead and dive in with a question. So you wrote an article earlier this year for CSO Online called 11 Ways to Hack Multi-Factor Authentication, which I think from what we've talked about offline, it's up to like 18 now. And I wanted to start with which attacks out of that do you think businesses aren't paying attention to enough currently?
Well, I think it's really overall just that it can be done. I mean, when you talk to most computer security people and certainly most organizations, they think if you have a multi-factor device, it means you don't have to worry about phishing or credential theft or hacking at all. You know, so it's that it's funny in that particular. I've given a presentation now around it, and it's called 12 Ways to Hack 2FA or MFA, and it is up to 18, but literally it takes like an hour and a half to demo them all. So I usually go through like 10 or 12 of them. But part of that is always this hacking demo by Kevin Mitnick, where he shows somebody receiving a phishing email, and they click on it and they respond and they put in their MFA, you know, pen that was sent to them for LinkedIn or something like that. And they, you know, it just works, and they take over his session token, his resulting successful authentication access control token, his cookie. And it amazes people. When Kevin first did it, people are like, oh my God, have you reported this yet to, you know, to the CVE? And we're like, no, that you've been able to do that for like 20 years. They're like, well, it works against Microsoft's, because Microsoft security sucks, which I kind of take, you know, I'm like, I worked for Microsoft for 12 years. Our security doesn't suck. They actually are on the forefront of security in a lot of ways. Yeah, it's a lot. They're no longer, you know, it's not Windows XP anymore. But what I was amazed, people said, well, it worked against Microsoft. So then Kevin did a demo and it worked against Gmail. And well, you can do it against Google, but it doesn't work. He did like five demos cracking all sorts of multi-factor authentication devices, and people were just astounded. And I don't mean your mother and father, right? I mean actual computer security people that do it for a living were astounded. So that's what that whole talk kind of came out of. Hey, just because you got a multi-factor authentication token or template or a smart card doesn't mean that you have to really, you don't have computer security solved.
So there's like two types of attacks that that demo might have showed, Roger. It might be interesting to go over both of them. One is, you mentioned he put up a phishing site to capture credentials. And one way you can do it is, say you're using one-time password as a second token. You could literally, in your phishing site, just ask the user for their one-time password, right? So in that case, we'll get to a session cookie as well, but in that case, just using plain phishing, you may not need the token, because you can kind of trick the user into sharing the one-time password. Is that one of the ways?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And of course, the other way I think you might have been alluding to is the fact that say the multi-factor was totally secure. You mentioned that there's a token. So talk a little bit more about that. After you authenticate, what actually happens on the computing end? How does the computer then, of course, pass that authentication?
Yeah, this is a fact that probably 99.9% of computer security professionals, even at our level, don't understand. And that is, no matter how you authenticate, and by that I mean whether you use a password, biometric, multi-factor authentication, however you authenticate, after you successfully authenticate that device, you know, a Windows laptop or a website or whatever, it always sends you some type of, hey, you're authenticated and here's your access control token that then is used by the operating system or network to you kind of the system behind the scenes hands that token off to say this person's authenticated and this is their identity. It may have group memberships in it, permissions and privileges, but no matter how you authenticate, you always get this resulting access control token. If you're on a Windows laptop and you're logging in with a password or a fingerprint, you're going to get an NTLM token or a Kerberos ticket. If you're on a website, it's 99.9% of the time going to be this cookie, which is just a text-based HTML file. And if the attacker can get a man-in-the-middle attack and access that access control token, they can take over your session, if not, you know, the entire thing.
Yeah, and I think some of our listeners might be aware of previous pass the hash type attacks with that. That would be with the NT Landman token, where, you know, who needs the credential once you have captured that hash, which is one of the types of tokens operating systems use to authenticate. You could just pass that in the background. So I think that's a great point. Even if the multi-factor authentication's totally reliable and wasn't captured, there is some sort of token there that the computers and network use to share that it was successful. Good point.
And it happened with happens with websites too. We saw it with Facebook just last month and a half ago, where someone was able to generate authentication tokens through a series of bugs in their view as feature.
Yeah. What's kind of wild is I think a lot of people think like, well, if I authenticate using, let's say, a fingerprint or a retina scan, that I think they think conceptually behind the scenes it's sending the fingerprint and the retina scan around the network and authenticating them to the databases. Like, nope, it's a Kerberos ticket.
Yep.
So another question, through all of your articles and presentations, you actually highlight on quite a few different types of multi-factor authentication. And I wanted to see if you have any like favorites or least favorites out of what appears to be industry norm multi-factor right now?
You know, it's interesting. Since I started giving this presentation and talk, probably it's been 4 or 6 months ago, and I've done it at Black Hat. I'm going to do it at RSA this year. I probably have at least two vendors a day send me their, hey, you can't hack my, you know, solution. So what I get to see is a lot of bad solutions, you know, that are just incredibly bad. And they're bad because of either they really don't prevent the hacking that I'm being told that they stop, or it's something like a, you know, a 14 bazillion factor solution. They're like, if you get the user to do these 16 things, it's unhackable. And I'm like, you know, people are just not going to use that. You know, so it's kind of interesting. It goes either it's a really poorly implemented multi-factor authentication solution, or they've got so much security on it, it becomes unusable. But I want to say that I do see gems. Like, I do see good solutions that come out of it where you look at it and you go, that's thoughtful, it's well made, it does prevent a lot of the easier types of attacks. So I tell you what, I have a couple of favorites, but I have a lot more. I hate the multi-factor authentication token because they're trying to sell the world on it's unhackable. And as soon as I see that word unhackable, it makes me think of like the Larry Ellison campaign of Oracle. You know, you're just, there's nothing that's
Litchfield.
Unhackable.
Yeah,
you're either you're marketing to me or you're naive. One of the two.
Yeah, we brought up that in a previous post. I was around during the David Litchfield days where Oracle made that claim and a particular security researcher proved them wrong over and over. So I agree, unhackable is something you shouldn't say. But to go a little deeper in Mark's question, let's say, for instance, like one we hear a lot about because it is, I guess it may not be easy to use because you do actually have to type a one-time password, but it's at least ubiquitous. So there's a lot of websites out there that are starting to allow text-based multi-factor where you don't need to have a special device. Everyone has a phone, doesn't even have to be a smartphone for text-based multi-factor. So at least they can send you a text. So what are your thoughts, say, on text-based multi-factor authentication? What are some weaknesses or strengths there?
So it's nice that it's a factor, but other than that, it's considered one of the weakest multi-factor authentication solutions. So bad that NIST, you know, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, in their special publications 800-63-3, the Digital Identity Guidelines, literally say you should not use it for authentication. It is horrible. There have been hundreds of millions of dollars of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies stolen in the last few months. You know, there are so many attacks. Millions of people have been compromised by that. Even like the Red Edit team a couple of months ago this year, you know, they used SMS, short message servicing, using text messages to authenticate for their admins, and they got compromised by what's called, you know, SIM card swapping or SIM information swapping, and the subscriber identity module is what SIM stands for. But they had not only their admin accounts compromised, but the people stole their source code as well, you know, when they were able to do that. But so what's interesting about this short messaging service is it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's like 99% of websites. You know, it's my banking website. Microsoft uses it. Facebook uses it. My identity, the service that I subscribed to, that I was given free subscription to because my identity was compromised, my fingerprint was compromised, and the OMB compromised a couple years ago, that service sends me a short messaging service. You know, it's, so I kind of laugh in that the NIST has said, it's so bad you shouldn't use it, yet literally everything that's important to me in my life pretty much uses it. And you're forced to.
The issue there, by the way, is probably kind of the interception or man in the middle thing. So one option is depending on if you can get access to a third party or a carrier, SMS is clear text, so they might intercept it there. But one thing you talk about too is also man in the device, or so is that another way I suppose someone might intercept a SMS message?
Yeah, I guess, although I don't see man in the device so much on mobile phones. The big thing
we've seen one or two Android Trojans that seem to gather SMS credentials.
Oh, okay. Actually, you're telling me something that I didn't see. So I appreciate the setup that I blew. The SIM swapping ones I see, what I'm kind of amazed about is the professional guys like literally pay somebody inside the cell phone company like $75 to do the SIM swap. You know, so they don't even really have to hack you. They've got an inside man. And one of the last big hacks here in Florida was some guy lost 24 million of Bitcoin, and they talked the AT&T rep into doing the SIM swap for $75. But man in the endpoint, I call it. You know, once your device is compromised, you can, you know, it's not your device. And it makes common sense that, you know, if my computer or cell phone's compromised, that they can do anything they want. But a lot of people, again, they have this, they put this special magical powers on a multi-factor authentication. They're like, well, they can't get this two-factor thing or this external thing. Yes, they can. I mean, it really becomes unimportant because they're now controlling your session as if they are you. They can get your access control token altogether. After you successfully authenticate, they can invalidate your protection. So you think you have the protection, but you don't. They completely can fake the experience. You know, you go to your bank's website on your cell phone and you think you're just looking at money and they're actually transferring it to some Russian bank in the background and you don't even know about it. So that's but I appreciate you telling me. I did not know that there is Android malware that did that.
Was trying to set you up.
Cool.
I'm gonna add that to my presentation. That's 19 ways.
Awesome. No. When does it stop?
Yeah, really.
So another question: Microsoft and Apple lately, among other companies, are really pushing to kill the password, as they say, and they're replacing them with just biometrics like fingerprints or Face ID, taking pictures of your face. Why do you think they're making these moves, and do you have any concerns with them, or do you think this really is the great way for the future?
So, you know, everybody wants to move from passwords because they're so easily phished and compromised, but I tell you what, I don't know if we ever will completely, because everybody knows how to use, you know, a login name and password, even, you know, a grandmother, grandfather. I was listening to a talk the other day by somebody out of Harvard, and they said just using a simple two-factor token like a YubiKey, single factor, where all you do is plug in your computer and hit the button, the failure rate on that is something like 40% across the general end user. They put them in upside down. They think they're their fingerprint biometrics. Like, I was imagine anything that's going to be secure is going to be more than that. And people can't even get that right. But going back to biometrics, I got to tell you, I'm becoming a huge enemy of biometrics. Biometrics as an authentication factor is horrible. For one, they're not secret. You know, it's literally your fingerprints are everywhere, and every time they tell us they have some unhackable biometric identity, you know, there's some 18-year-old kid on YouTube 18 hours later that's hacked around it for free or for $80, right? Like I've yet to see the biometric solution that some kid didn't hack when he tried. So I'm a little bit concerned. Not only that, but like, let's say my password was compromised along with 5.6 million other people. Anyone that applied for a U.S. security clearance had their 10 fingerprints stolen by Chinese APT in 2015 from the Office of Ombudsman or whatever, OMB.
OPM. OPM, Office of Personnel Management.
Thank you. I got my acronyms wrong. But, you know, like once they're stolen and they're in another nation state, supposedly the Chinese gave Obama back that database in some type of, you know, goodwill attempt, but I'm having a feeling they probably made a copy of that. But like,
I was going to say, yeah, digital, it's pretty easy to give back something while not really giving it back.
Yeah, but I'm like, how can any system that really needs to trust me based upon my fingerprints ever trust it, right? You can't repudiate it. You can't change it. Like, I'm all right with biometrics as long as you have at least one other factor paired with it. But by itself, they're just horrible. You know, the whole, you know, look at the laptop or even the connected dots is another one I have a problem with. You know, like, yeah, people have their phone and they do. That's the only authentication solution that I can hack across the room the first time. You're like, oh, they did a Z, then an upside down L. Like literally, yep. You don't have to be Kevin Mitnick to hack connect the dots. Like, it is the worst. And if you read, what's funny is if you read the scientific papers, like, oh, it's a 1 in 20 billion chance somebody could hack that. I'm like, did you talk to my five-year-old? Because my five-year-old was able to hack my connect the dots password.
I think they have scientific papers, too, similar to passwords. Everyone seems to use the same 20 patterns every time. So I think something like 80% of the time, 20 patterns will get you in with that.
Yeah.
By the way, one thing you said, like, we agree with you on biometrics. I think, like, a Microsoft Hello, obviously they're moving to different authentication methods because of passwords having some weaknesses. But it seems to me they're going single factor biometrics. Like you, biometrics are great for usability, but I don't think any single token's ever perfect. So going from one single factor to another seems silly to me. But you brought up a very important question that I think people don't think about, and it's that the password's not dead. It's not gone. You have this biometric that you set up with Windows Hello, but the first thing it asks you to do is to set up that backup passcode, right? Because as you say, tokens or in some cases biometrics will fail. So you need that password still there as the backup means to get in. And what's worse is because they're using biometrics rather than having a password, they make it a PIN, a passcode, as the default. So they're asking for a less secure type of password as a backup, and they're storing it in the same way. It's in a hash database. So really, all the same password attacks like Mimikatz and stuff like that still exist, even if you're using this new Windows Hello, because there's a password database still sitting there for a backup.
You're exactly right. Now, let me go further. I think the problem I have with biometrics bigger is that if it took over the world, biometrics works in like a barely works, but has some type of ability to work in a closed-in environment in a physical place where you could possibly be arrested. But once you start going to biometrics in a remote scenario, it's absolutely worthless, right? Because your attacker can guess to their heart's content in a remote way and not worry about getting arrested. I mean, part of the biometric piece of it is that, at least when I'm at work, is that, you know, I could be caught and people know me when I'm at the fingerprint scanner. And even the other thing about biometrics that I hate is that everybody thinks they're so unique. Like, your fingerprint is unique in the world. Yeah, your fingerprint may be nearly unique in the world, but the fingerprint that the fingerprint scanner reads, no, that matches lots of people probably within your building. I mean, even in my building, my company, Know Before Today, we don't have 100,000 employees, and there's multiple people in here whose fingerprints match other people's fingerprints the way the fingerprint scanner reads them. You know, biometric scanners are, they actually have to detune them to have, otherwise they'd have far too many false positives and false negatives. So they're just horrible. Like,
well, that's a great segue, by the way, for a question I think Mark has.
Yeah. So I don't know if you read the research paper that came out of New York University a few months ago now, where they published a paper where they used machine learning to create a fingerprint master key, is what they called it, where they used two different models to create and then test fingerprints until they found one that could fool a fingerprint reader to varying degrees of success. And they actually had pretty good efficacy with it, depending on how secure they set the fingerprint reader to be. And I wanted to ask, like, is this a practical attack of the future? And do you think that machine learning is going to have a big impact on authentication for attackers coming up?
Yeah, so I did read that paper and it scared me like it scared you, you know, and I think I've even read since then someone's making like this holistic biometric database to try to fake all the possible fingerprints and retina scans. I mean, it only makes sense. And they're actually trying to determine how much entropy that needs to be introduced into biometric identities. Well, but that is kind of scary that you can think a spy could pull up with, you know, like an iPod device and he's got every possible combination of fingerprint and, you know, and thing involved. And that, that you know, the amazing thing about a lot of biometrics, there's no account lockout. Like when you're doing a fingerprint scanner, if it didn't account lockout, you would never get in that door, even if you're a legitimate user. I mean, because it has to guess. It's looking at your fingerprint 1,000 times trying to recognize it in its database. So once you have those biometric holistic databases, you know, that can that will have every possible fingerprint and facial thing that would work, you got to think you've got a one size fits all device that will just hack them all. Yeah, when I read that paper, yeah, it scared me to death.
Us too.
Yeah, that was a wake up call when, oh my God, someone's working on this. Oh my God.
And we've seen examples you don't even need like machine learning to make a fingerprint master key. If you have access to a gummy bear, you can just lift a fingerprint and stick it on a fingerprint reader sometimes.
Yeah, my favorite, I was once in charge of evaluating 17 fingerprint scanners, and the flatbed ones were particularly susceptible, but you could just cup your hand over the flatbed scanner, blow hot air, and it would reactivate the oils and log you. And it was something like 7 of the 17 that would work on. And so
it's reactivating the fingerprint that's actually on the glass of the reader.
Yeah. We started, and it was funny that some of our guys came in and they had all these cans of air, you know, that had different chemicals that would try to reactivate it. But this guy beside me just cupped his hands and did it. I would love to take credit for it, but another guy discovered it, that he just cupped and blew hot air and it had enough moisture in it that it reactivated the fingerprint.
By the way, that's crazy. I don't think some people even think about that. The fact that, you know, there are ways like the OPM hack we mentioned where you can steal the digital fingerprints, but there usually people are like, well, the hard part about fingerprint attacks is how do you pull the fingerprint? But it's right there on the reader. Like if this is a public reader at a door or whatever, there's no better place to pull fingerprints than the thing people put their finger on to authenticate. So, wow, that opened my eyes, Roger.
That's insane. So I guess we've been talking about a lot of scary things and ways to defeat multi-factor authentication. And through your presentations and articles, you talk about quite a few different ways to hack multi-factor authentication. And I wanted to see if you had any suggestions or tips for companies to defend against these attacks or set themselves up where they don't become a victim while still having secure multi-factor authentication.
Yeah, so the first thing is that it's funny. Some people see my talks and go, well, Roger thinks multi-factor authentication sucks and won't work. No, it's, you know, they're good and it's better than single factor for the scenarios. The problem, like why passwords may not go away, is that you can't use, no matter what your multi-factor solution is, it rarely works everywhere, right? Like if you decide, I love Google Authenticator, I love it, or YubiKeys, well, that's good. You can use it on like 1% of the world's assets, right? So you're probably, it's going to be tough to find one that works in all scenarios. But what I will say is there are good solutions out there, you know, and just because they can be hacked doesn't mean that they're worthless. It's not a binary thing. Like one of the things I kind of look for is that your multi-factor solution is replay resistant, meaning if they get a hold of that access control token, either it's harder to get a hold of that access control token or if somebody else gets a hold of it. Like, so the solution is looking at traits that make it harder for a man in the middle of the guy steal it. A lot of times that means that your device that you're using has to be pre-registered with a central database or with the website. Like with YubiKeys, you have to go, you know, pre-register that YubiKey to work with each and every website, but then it actually is trying to get back to that YubiKey and be authenticated, or it's looking at your IP address, or what does WatchGuard have? I think you'll have a neat solution.
Yeah, so we have a product called AuthPoint, and if I were to share a couple features with you just to grade, you know, one of the things we do is it's entirely mobile-based because, as you say, to get good multi-factor, it's a combination of convenience and security. So we're trying to make it easy, but we don't want to lose security. So some of the things we do, and maybe you can comment on each individually, one of the first is rather than texts, we use something called mobile push. So this actually uses the notification services of people like Google and Apple to actually push, you know, the back and forth communication, which includes things like, you know, there's a seed on the device and at the server, and there's certificates and things like that. But the key thing is notification is HTTPS encrypted. So it is over an encrypted channel. So that's one. The other thing we do is, one, it's biometric enabled. So if you want to turn on biometrics, you do have to authenticate to your phone before you can even get to the point where you approve an authentication. And finally, one thing we do, and this kind of helps with the SIM cloning you talked about, or even things like that, is we have something called digital DNA. So we have some, besides the IME number, there's a number of unique identifiers in each mobile phone, which, as you say, has to be pre-registered with us, that we mix into the you know, the challenge response with the seed ID and other things. So that's what we do at WatchGuard with AuthPoint.
Yeah, you know, and let me say, I like those solutions, and I like hearing those types of solutions, especially because a lot of what you talked about is seamless to the end user, right?
Yep.
And that's the better part. Some of the solutions I see that are kind of counteractive is when they got the user doing three things or five things. You know, I've seen sometimes where I swear to God, I'm not making this up, and I'm probably going to hurt the person's feelings if they listen into this, but their solution involved the end user getting a couple of numbers and solving a mathematical equation.
Oh, no. Hope they get it right.
And like, literally,
test of math skills.
It was early in the demo. It was like, you add these two numbers, you invert these two numbers, and then you multiply by 10. And I was like, I'm sorry, you're asking your end user to perform, you know, math? He goes, well, it's pretty easy. I'm like, you're not going to get anybody to buy that. And he's like, well, we've already realized it's not good for the commercial, or it's not good for the home user, so we're going to focus on high security. I'm like, they're not going to do it either, because the high security markets, you know what, they're full of people. You know, full of people that don't want to do bits of
the
math.
Same people that, yeah. Good point.
But if you get a solution like what y'all have, which is, I have the user do a couple of things. I'm locking it to a device and locking it to a user. And then we behind the scenes are looking at other attributes and traits to ensure better security. Those are better, more reliable solutions. What's interesting is, it's like your engineers actually thought, what can we do to secure the process that doesn't involve more friction to the end user? And they came up with a solution. That's what more of them need to do.
And really, like you say, I mean, other than unlocking the phone, all you really do is press an approve button. It's not a matter of, I mean, we have options to type the one-time password if you really need to back up to an offline model. But it really is, as you say, we try to do a lot of cryptography and other stuff in the background. So all they have to do is just approve it on their phone. And we know it's their phone based on that digital DNA. So if people either push the SIM to a different phone, we'll know that because the digital DNA won't match. Or for really sophisticated attacks where they try to clone a phone, even then we can tell it's not the right hardware.
That's pretty cool to hear.
So we talked about companies. How about end users? Do you have any tips on like how to avoid getting phished or how to avoid getting your multi-factor token stolen?
Yeah, well, my only big tip is that to know that anybody can be phished, anybody, and it's not an IQ test. If you're appropriately motivated, you know, and the email catches you in a weak period of time, anybody can be phished. And like we've been trying to track down, how do you convert the people that are the, you know, those clickers that click on anything? Like literally, you're like, you seem to be the dumbest person I've ever met, because everything in that email, you know, screams scam. It says, it literally has the word Nigerian prince in it. You know, how did you get scammed? But you know, what we found out is that the people that are most susceptible to it just don't know about the particular scam. Like last week, there was this scam of everybody got these emails saying there was a bomb threat and you better send me bitcoins or we're going to blow your
school.
And I was amazed by how many schools shut down, how many people called the police and bomb threat teams came in and cleared the school. And I'm sure we were like, I can't believe you shut down a whole school system because you got a single email. But I guess it's safety. But I think a big part of it was they just weren't aware of those sort of scams. Now most people are. But so I would say my hint is that you literally, the best thing anyone can do is to be aware of the type of scams. Like if you haven't heard of the IRA, if you haven't heard that Microsoft doesn't proactively call you to get rid of a virus on your computer, you may be susceptible to it. So my hint to end users and to any company literally is to make people just aware. Like that's what you have to do is share these types. You've got to go, hey, the IRS is not going to call you and ask you to go get green dot cards to pay off some penalty.
Exactly.
You know, IRS doesn't use Walmart green dot cards.
Yeah. Buy us Applebee gift certificates and we'll let your tax debt go.
Yeah. But it's funny when we were trying to figure out why are these people so susceptible, it just turned out the less criminally minded you are, the more susceptible you are. And if you've never been introduced to that type of scam, you're susceptible to it.
Well, that kind of sucks. You know, that means some of the best, most moral people are the ones that fall for this stuff.
But that is something
I could see how that's true.
We agree with it too. Like training and user training is one of the best preventions when it comes to phishing. You can have all the best technical protections in the world, but if your end user is a happy clicker and that one email comes through, they're screwed.
Yeah, you everything's always a combination of training and technical. And I hate solutions that claim that you only need one of them. You know, because the technical stuff, no matter how good it is, it's occasionally going to fail. And you need to have people that are trained. You know, it's kind of like being in a car. Like now we're getting all these cars with it. And let me say, I can't wait to buy a new car so it can have all the sensors so I won't accidentally hit someone and I won't turn into the left lane and the right lane. But the problem is you're always going to have to be somewhat aware because your car is going to make the wrong decision one day. I think it was even that Elon Musk was in that video and he was showing 60 Minutes last week how great the car driving thing was. And it literally cut the car off during the 60 Minutes interview, right?
I need to go see that video. Yeah, I have not seen that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You're like, it did all right, but not really perfect.
Well, we agree with you. Vigilance. Vigilance is definitely... one of the best defenses.
For this question, I want to test your clairvoyance abilities, and I wanted to see what you think the future for authentication looks like. Like in the year 2030, are we still running around with passwords, or do we have something better in the next decade and a half or so? Where do you think we're going?
Well, I don't know, and you know, will we have passwords 10 or 20 years from now? I don't know. You know, let me say, I thought we were getting rid of all computer viruses in 1990. Because we had really good scanners, and it turns out I was wrong on that one. But what the best I can tell, at least where the industry is headed to, is stuff that is continuous authentication, meaning you're not just authenticated at the beginning and then allowed to do everything, that you'll get these different levels. Like maybe you'll pick up your cell phone, you'll go to your banking website, and you'll not be asked. As far as you know, you're not being asked to log in. It's doing something to go, this probably is Roger. And then you're able to do things. And then if you go to transfer all your money to a new Russian bank, then it's going to prompt you for more authentication. So it's going to be continuous. It'll be adaptive. And it will be, I think, more frictionless. And what I mean by that is the future authentication is probably for our kids and grandkids. They're probably not going to be entering in a lot of passwords. They're probably not even going to be doing a lot of this, you know, I have to have this two-factor token or something. It's going to literally be measuring hundreds of attributes about them. Although, like already, Gmail and Hotmail already measure 150 to 200 attributes. And that was years ago when I checked into it. It looked at your IP address. It looked, you know, at your habits. They even look at like how long it takes you to type in your password. Like you ever notice like when you put in your login name, you go to a second screen that asks you for the password? That's because it's measuring your typing speed between the different letters of your password and how quickly you type in your password to determine is this you or not. And it's that. It's going to be these behavioral, when we say biometric, it's going to be, hey, is this, you know, is his hands clammy? I don't know. Does he smell right today? But it's going to be all these factors that will be added up to a risk score. So I think it's going to be more like your credit card, meaning that think about all the times you use your credit card or debit card and it just kind of lets you use it. And then you do something strange and they send you a short messaging service text and go, hey, is that you buying the TV at Walmart? And you say yes or no. I think the future of authentication is continuous, frictionless, and adaptive.
Yeah. By the way, for those out there playing buzzword bingo, one acronym you might want to remember is YUBA, or User in Entity Behavioral Analytics. And I think that speaks to what you're saying, Roger, where it's all about monitoring tons and tons of activities of users. And as you say, that becomes the continuous, is this guy doing something we've seen before? Of course, being an InfoSec expert and a paranoid, if you think about all the data companies will have on all our habits, that brings a whole new scary thing into the picture. While yes, we now don't have to do anything to authenticate because they know what we do. But now if an attacker gets a hold of all that data, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I feel like we live in 1954 for sure. Or I'm sorry, 19. Oh, why am I getting it wrong? There we go, 18.
We live in 2018, Corey, or probably 2019 by the time this airs.
It's amazing. It's amazing how close George Orwell had everything in 1984. Yeah, you know, I even worry. It's funny. Although I laugh, people are like, well, what about if, you know, the bots become self-aware and they start to kill us? I'm like, have you looked at how crummy programming is? There's always full of bugs. And I think the neat thing about AI is that even if it's self-learning, AI can only really learn what it's a behavior. Like it's got to see this behavior a bunch to go, hey, that's normal. And that's how we'll defeat them. If they're trying to kill us, I think we'll just send somebody in the right flank a whole bunch so they think that's normal behavior, and then we'll shoot them and kill them from the left flank.
That's give them wrong data.
That's how I'm taking down Skynet. I just
or it will be an off by one error that some programmer forgot about. Memory corruption flaw in Skynet, for sure.
That's right. That's right.
So before we sign off, is there any last tip or word of advice you want to leave our audience with?
Yeah, I tell you what, the reason why I'm in this field still, I love computer security, but I think I'm going to spend the last 15 years of my career doing this one thing, which is, I call it a data-driven defense. I've written books and white papers and stuff, but it's this idea that the stuff that you need to really worry about is not what 99% of the time people are talking about. And by that I mean is there's 15,000 things a year you're being told that are high priority you need to worry about. And the truth is that there maybe are a handful of things that cause most of the risk and compromises in most environments. And to be a better computer geek, a better computer security person, professional, the better that you can realize what are the right things to really worry about, the better a computer professional you can be. Because everyone's telling you to fear everything. And really, it's in a given year, it's social engineering and unpatched software is 90% of your risk, right? But we're not putting 90% of our resources against stopping phishing and patching stuff better. And when you go to patch, you don't have to patch 15 things. There's like 12 things in a given year. There's 12 programs that most of the attackers focus on. So if you would better focus on patching those 12 things, your organization would be far better off than worried about all of these. I talk to groups, I'm like, what's your biggest fear? They're like, well, cloud security. I'm like, really? Really? That's your biggest fear? It's not patching Adobe Acrobat?
Yeah, there you go. Or Flash.
Yeah.
Well, by the way, the audience heard in your intro that Roger has a number, I think like over 10 books out there now, but I actually own a data-driven computer security defense. So if you're addicted to Amazon Prime like me, know that's available for Kindle editions. If you have a waterproof iPad, you can read it in the hot tub like me. God. Mark thinks I'm crazy.
That's great.
But fantastic books. So go out and check some of them out on Amazon or whether your physical or digital book reader you use.
Yep. And I mentioned earlier, you've got a weekly column on CSO Online as well. And I'm sure all our viewers can find you on Twitter. What's your handle, Roger?
Roger A. Grimes.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Roger, for sitting down with us. This was a very fun talk we had. And I hope we can bring you back too.
You guys are great. I think y'all have got one of the best podcasts on the internet on this topic. I think y'all have the secret sauce.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. And also, thank you, Roger. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_, Corey at @SecAdept, and Roger at Roger A. Grimes. You can also get your daily dose of security news and insights at secplicity.org. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week.